Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Before we start, what episode are we on?
Nine.
It is nine. Okay, ready?
Hello and welcome to the Motormouth podcast with Harry Benjamin and Tim Sylvie. In this episode, we chat to Karun Chandhok, Sky Sports F1 pundit, the second ever Indian Formula One driver and the first Indian Formula E driver. Karun has driven pretty much everything and is a wealth of knowledge. He kindly invited us to his home a few days ago to chat about his career and life, which is just such an incredible journey. It's so interesting, from racing anything he could get his hands on in India to the Formula One grid. It's a truly humbling story. We hope you enjoy. And don't forget to like and subscribe. Just search for the Motormouth podcast on your favourite podcast platform, where you can also leave us a review. And don't forget, you can download the Motormouth app, where you can get live race times, exclusive video content from MMTV, create your own social profile, and check up on all the latest happenings with whatever motorsport takes your fancy.
So welcome to episode 9 of the Motormouth podcast. We're hugely honoured to have Karun Chandhok on the show today, our first ever F1 driver. Born to Indian parents in 1984, Karun has raced all over the world on the biggest stages, including, as we know, Formula 1, also Formula E and the World Endurance Championship, and now plies his trade, pounding the paddock, broadcasting Formula 1 to the masses. He's coached Isle of Man TT legend Guy Martin, consults for Williams Heritage Business, has his own karting carnival, and is the first Indian ever to be accepted into the BRDC. He's also had the pleasure of driving the current and very dominant Mercedes F1 car. We've got lots to talk about. A huge Motormouth welcome to you, Karun Chandhok.
Thank you very much. Really happy to be here.
Yeah, thank you for letting us come into your living room. You've supplied us with custard creams, ginger nuts, tea. It's a very, very lovely service you have going here.
And please.
It's a good choice of biscuits, actually.
Well, I mean, I am partial to a ginger nut. I think that's...
They're an underrated biscuit, I think.
Yeah. Now, we saw each other very recently. You were in the States, obviously, for the F1. We caught up briefly in the paddock. I was in the paddock.
I know. I feel like the first question I should ask is, I apparently am the only one sitting around this coffee table that didn't go to America. How was Austin?
It was good. It was cold, though. Day one, Friday was freezing.
Well, Thursday and Friday was absolutely freezing. It got better as the weekend went on, but, I mean, I love it. It's probably my favourite, if not one of my top three races of the year, I think. Austin.
Really?
Yeah, it's a great city. Great vibe, good restaurants, you know, great live music. And actually, the race itself, you know, there's always a bit of drama. And the crowd was incredible,
yeah,
this year, wasn't it? Sunday was absolutely rammed.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I think the crowds have actually gone up on previous years. I got there on Friday morning at the track, and it was sold out.
It seems like for the last few years, it's always been a constant, America trying to make its mark in Formula 1. And now it seems that this is starting to stabilise a bit, and it's here to stay, and it's doing a good job as the first American track.
I met the guys from ESPN, who are the broadcasters in the States, and yep, their numbers are up over 22% or something.
Wow.
This year.
Oh, wow.
So for US viewership, which is amazing, really.
Yeah.
And I think that reflects in what we saw at the track. As Tim said, it was sold out on Sunday. And I think, you know, more people are watching on telly. They're going, "Ooh, this is cool. Let's go watch the race in Austin." And then they turn up. So, yeah, very cool.
Nice.
And a fairly emphatic performance from not only Lewis Hamilton, but Bottas. Like, he was on it.
We're not biased, but I was rooting for him to just to try and keep things alive a bit more. Obviously, there's not much he could have done really more than what he did. But I feel like the race was hyped up quite a lot at the start, as you would do. And then it kind of petered out midway through. But then just at the end with Hamilton's going long and then undercutting and all that, it does provide, there is still, we always have the same conversation. Oh, Formula One's boring. How do we spice it up? But you're not, it is interesting and it is dramatic. It is one, even though Championship sealed the deal before the season's up.
Yeah, I mean, I get really annoyed by people saying things like that because at the end of the day, not every minute of a football match is entertaining. No. Not every minute of a cricket match is entertaining. It can't be.
Yeah.
I don't think the race in Austin was particularly outstanding, but it was a decent race. There was bits going on. There was, you know, bit of drama, bit of, you know, action between the leaders. It was a decent race. And there are lots of things, of course, we can do to improve the sport. I'm sure we'll get into that. But I do get annoyed by people going, "Oh, it was boring. Oh, yeah. It was better back in the 80s. No, it wasn't. Prost and Senna used to win races by laps.
Yeah.
I think we tend to look back with rose tinted glasses.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, when you look back to those Senna days, and, you know, Mansell, I remember watching, and there'd be like a 3-minute gap between first and second or third, you know. And I think we forget that back in the day, it wasn't, you know, action non-stop. I think there's probably more action now, more overtake. I mean, first couple of laps in Austin, you had Norris flying past people, you had Ricciardo going nuts, you had Albon coming from the back to go up into fifth or sixth or wherever he finished.
Yeah.
There was action. It was a race.
No, it was brilliant. But Karun, we are here to mainly talk about you. So let's start right at the beginning. What was that first glint in your eye where you were like, right, I want to be a racing driver?
I don't know the exact moment. I don't think there was a moment as such. It's I grew up in a house full of motorsport. My dad used to race. My granddad used to race. We ran a garage, basically, a workshop fixing cars and, you know, ended up running a race in a rally team. So I grew up in that environment. We'd have people from motorsport coming in and out of the house and the office all the time. So to me, it just seemed like a natural thing to do. You know, as far as I can remember, I wanted to be a racing driver. And then I grew up to be a racing driver. And I think it was only when I got to my mid-20s, probably, when I started meeting friends of mine from high school who, you know, they finished high school, they've gone off to university. Some of them have done their you know, masters or you know, postgraduate degrees, and they're still trying to work out what they want to do in life. And I couldn't really understand that because I was like, well, surely you know what you want to do in life. And it's only, I think, at that point I realized I was quite unique. So
was it cut and dry for you? You thought, I know what I'm going to be and it's going to be a racing.
Yeah, exactly. As far as I can remember, I think I was probably 3-4 years old and already, you know, dreaming of being a Formula One driver one day. So it was a fairly straightforward choice in terms of what I want to do. Getting there was anything but straightforward, of course. But I don't think I ever thought of doing anything else, really.
And your little boy is obviously going to follow in your footsteps. I've seen him tearing around the kitchen this morning in his little mini Formula One car.
No, he is not. I'm going to encourage tennis, cycling, table tennis,
but
golf.
Yeah, the low entry sports, swimming is a great one.
Yeah, exactly.
Cheap as you like.
Yeah, exactly. So, to be honest, I think a life in sport is hard in any sport. But it helps you get a bit of focus. I think, you know, focuses the mind, especially in the teenage years and stuff. And you know, when you see kids sort of just meandering through life and waking up at 11 o'clock in the morning, not really knowing what they want to do. I think sport gives you a focus and it gives you something to really get your mind tuned into. So, you know, I'd like him to take up a sport, whether it's to a professional level where he earns a living out of it is a different story, but I think it does help.
Yeah, brilliant. Now, so growing up, you were saying obviously you were surrounded by motorsport. So were you born in India?
Yeah, in Madras, and born and raised. So I only moved to England, I still remember, on the 1st of February 2002 to come and race at Formula 3. So
how long were you growing up in India for then? How old were you then?
Until I was 18.
Oh, right, okay. So Now, we had the Indian Grand Prix, of course. We don't anymore. What is the motorsport scene like in India? How come you were so surrounded by motorsport? Because on the surface of it, it doesn't seem like motorsport is a top priority there. So how comes you happen to be surrounded by it? And was there much to do when you were growing up in India in terms of getting that track action?
I was very lucky in that respect, to be honest, because as I said, my family were in the business, so to speak. But also, I grew up in Madras, very close to the racetrack, and which was the first permanent racetrack we had there. So it meant that I could spend all of my free time going to the races. And you know, the level at the time wasn't at a very high professional level. There weren't, you know, big manufacturers and things like that. And in fact, there was no karting, for example. So I never did a go-kart race in my life, which when I look at it, when I came to Europe and started looking back in hindsight, that was a huge disadvantage. You know, you think of people my age, you know, Hamiltons and Rosbergs, and you know, I race with Kubica and World Series stuff. You know, they've done so many years of karting.
Yeah,
they've built that muscle memory up, and therefore, when they get to cars and single seaters, they're just there straight away. You know, I think my dad and people like that in the 70s and 80s, he raced with people like Vijay Mallya and stuff, and they would just go off to different parts of the country and race on disused airfields, basically.
Oh wow!
And then by the time I came along, we had sort of single make categories of racing, and that's when I started out.
So how does a young Indian chap coming over to the UK for the first time, how do you find yourself in Formula One? That can't have been as easy as it sounds. What was the process to get there?
Especially with no karting, yeah.
Yeah, it was obviously a long process because I came, you know, I started off in 2000, so it took me 10 years to get there. But I raced in India for a year, I raced in Asia for a season in 2001, and then came across here to do Formula 3. And, you know, I landed, as I said, in February in the middle of winter, and you're going,
yuck,
what is going on here? I mean, why is it dark at 3 o'clock? Yeah. I just couldn't comprehend what was going on. And, you know, it was very hard because things like I'd never driven the wet before. I'd never driven on cold tyres before because in Asia it was always 40-degree track temp.
When you came over at that point, was that with family or were you coming over on your own?
No, my dad came with me just to set me up. And so we went across to meet the team in, it was a team called T-Sport in Brackley.
Yeah.
And I went up there and it was so funny because, you know, I came from Madras, a city of 11 million people. And the first day I go to do the seat fit and meet the team and they go, oh, where are you going to live? And I said, well, right now we're, you know, staying at a hotel at Heathrow, so, yeah, you know. And so they said, well, and I didn't know anybody else. So they went, well, why don't you live in Brackley and at least we're here and we'll get to, you know, at least you'll have some friends around. So I remember going with the estate agent around the town to look at some houses. And I said to the estate agent, I said, so is this the suburb of the city? And the guy looked at me and said, we've done 3 laps of the town already. I was like, oh, okay.
But how's your mindset at that stage? I mean, coming over, okay, you're with your dad, but it's a huge cultural change.
Yep.
You're being chucked into British Formula 3, a hugely competitive series. What were you thinking? You got here, it's all dark. Are you thinking, what on earth have I done? Take me home. Or this is it. This is the start of my dream.
The first 6 months were very hard because, as you say, it was a cultural shift. You know, I couldn't cook. I couldn't even make a cup of tea. The first day I went, the team said, oh, yeah, you're the new boy. You can make a cup of tea. I went in the kitchen, turned the kettle on. I had no idea what to do next. I'd never made a cup of tea.
Well, can I confirm your skills have improved there?
Thanks.
Cappuccino was exceptional.
Oh, well, there we go.
But, you know, the thing is, at that age, you're young, you're the fire is so strong. Yeah. The motivation is so high to get to Formula One. You'd charge through walls. You'd do anything. And, you know, I come from a city where it was 35 degrees to being here in the colder winter. But, you know, you put your shoes on and you go out for a run and you just suck it up and you get on with it because you know if you're not doing it, there's some Brazilian or Japanese kid out there or, you know, someone else who is. And I think that you're young, dumb and motivated. And in a way that does help you to just power on. And that's what I did, you know, but I had a lot of shunts in the first part of that career when I came across and it took me a while to find my feet. And then I did. But then the money problem started because the rupee plummeted against the pound, which was a real problem for us in that phase. And, you know, so between 2004, 2005, you know, I'd really pretty much run out of money and everything had stalled. So I went back to Asia 2006 for a season to race there. And
taking seven wins, no less. I have done my research.
Yeah, you really have. Nine poles from 12 races as well, all that.
I didn't remember that. but yeah, no, I went back to Asia for a season. And but even at the end of that, I'd run out of money. I had no money. And I thought, right, that's it, I'm done. And I'd spoken to a friend of mine, Anthony Hyatt, who runs Double R Racing, mm-hmm. the Formula 3 team. And basically, I'd said to him, I said, look, I'm done. I mean, you know, I spent my whole life in motorsport. I haven't got any degrees. Can I get a job with you as a team manager? And he said, okay, yeah, let's talk about that. We can do that. And then, so we'd actually started talking about work permits and paperwork and things like that. And then I got a phone call from before that. I'd met with Bernie, and Bernie was helping me out to try and sort something out, but I hadn't heard anything from him over the winter. I spoke to him in November, early November, and he said, okay, leave it with me, I'll sort something out for GP2. And then November went, Christmas went, half of January, most of January went.
Oh, right.
And I hadn't heard anything back, and then suddenly I got a phone call from Bernie saying, right, I've done a deal with Durango. Red Bull want to back you and put you on the Young Driver program. So this is Danny Baja's number at Red Bull. Give him a call. And he wants to do something because, they need another driver at GP2. And the first test is next week at Paul Ricard. Good wow. luck. And he put the phone down.
And at that point, you fall off your
Bernie
chair.
Typical Bernie style.
Yeah. God, that's unbelievable. So Durango. And then GP2... First win, Spa.
Yeah, I mean, it was a funny one because when I did the deal with Durango, they had finished last in the championship the previous yeah. season, and that was the last seat remaining on the grid. So it was a bit of a desperate move to keep my career alive. But I didn't care. You know, I was in GP2
yeah.
and a step below F1.
Formula 1 in your sights, yeah.
And there you are. So off I went to Ricard, and I was very lucky. It was a typically mad, chaotic Italian team. But I had an English engineer, Nick Wasilio, who was very good at being quite organized. And in amongst all of this chaos, we had our own little bubble where we just got our heads down and focused and got the job done. And, again, the first half of the season, I was a rookie and we had a bit of bad luck. You know, I should have won in Turkey, but Nakajima took me out. And, we had a few decent results on the table, which didn't quite work out. But then from the second half of the season onwards, I scored points in every race and, as you say, won at Spa, which was very cool. You know, yeah. to win at Spa was a mixture of relief and joy because, you know, I'd had 3 years out of the European limelight, really, just wasn't there but not really there and scrambling for money. We were completely skint at that point. Family was mortgaged to the hilt and it was a real struggle 2004-5-6. So that was a real relief to sort of get put back on the map. And because of that, then Christian and Helmut gave me, you know, some tests with the F1 team. I started doing some simulator work all of that started to snowball from there.
Just before that stage with Red Bull, talking about money and finances, obviously it's a nightmare trying to raise funds, whether it's through, you know, remortgaging houses or sponsorship. How are you funding yourself at this point? Is it literally family bending over backwards to help? Have you gone out and found some sponsors in India? What are you doing to support yourself?
No, it was a mixture. I was very lucky. I had a company called JK Tires that backed me for my first ever race. And then, off the back of that, there was a battery company called Amron. Kingfisher tipped in a little bit yeah. on occasion. And there were a couple of other smaller Indian companies as well that supported me. But it was a real challenge because, you know, when I started out in 2000, the rupee was 50 to the pound.
Wow.
And by the time I got to GP2, the rupee was 85 to the pound. So, for us, it was a huge problem in terms of the budget. And also to sell motorsport to the Indian sponsors, to the Indian audiences, wasn't so easy then. It's still not easy now, no. frankly, but it was much harder then because the knowledge was quite low. You know, I remember going to press conferences at go-kart tracks, for example, and you'd have a journalist from, I'll never forget this, there's a journalist from the Times of India, which is the widest circulated paper in the country. And he looked at me and went, so what's the difference between this and a Formula One car? And he just, you know, that's the level of knowledge that there was in some pockets of the time. I'm generalizing, of course, there were some very knowledgeable journalists, but on the whole, it was still quite low, the level on average. So, yeah, it was a challenge, but, you know, we grafted away and pounded away and built the knowledge base, built the sport up as well, because that was half the challenge. You're trying to build up yourself as well as the sport, hand in hand. And, you know, raising funds was probably the most difficult part of the sport. And in many ways, and I'm not making excuses for myself, but in many ways that was also things that hurt. You know, I think back to Formula 3. I remember being in Pembrey in a mid-season test in 2004, and I was sharing the garage with Nelson Piquet Jr., who was, of course, no shortage of funding there.
Yep.
And, you know, by that stage, he had used twice as many sets of tyres and done twice as much testing as I had.
Yep.
And you're trying to compete on the same level. He's got new engines every weekend. He's, you know, it's just money, no object. Mm. You can't compete with people like that.
No, you can't. And unfortunately, that is one of the perils of motorsport, isn't it? I mean, even at the karting level, we've talked about it before. Mm. You could go through £100,000 easily on a 10-year-old kid. It's unbelievable. And then when you reach, you know, GP2, or formerly GP2, F2, Formula 1 levels, you know, when you've got the likes of Lance Stroll, you know, how on earth are you meant to compete with that?
But I think at least now with FIA, F3 and GP2, even then and in Formula 2 now, there is a bit more of an equivalence.
Things are a bit more regulated, aren't they?
Yeah, because, you know, testing is limited. The number of tyres are limited. The engines are all the same.
Yeah, sure.
You're limited on the number of engines and turbos and things you get. So actually, there is a bit more of an equaliser. Of course, the good teams are always going to be the good teams, and budget does help that, because you can hire better people and have a bit more R&D. But it's less of less of an unequal situation than there was in F3 back then, where you could go to Neil Brown and get a new engine every day you wanted to, basically.
Yeah, sure.
Let's talk about that relationship with Red Bull. So how did that start? How do you look back on it now, considering, you know, that is still very much a Red Bull driver program that runs today, and I think very much divides opinion on how useful versus damaging it can be to a driver's career?
I don't think it can be damaging at all.
Okay.
I always disagree with people on that, because, you know, at the end of the day, Helmut is hard and Christian is hard, but they're hard because they expect results. Mm. As long as you're delivering results, they're happy with you. You know, I feel very lucky to have worked with them in the time that I did. They gave me my first chance to drive a Formula One car and see what a team like that can be, because at the time they were still building up to championship success. You know, they paid for me to go racing in GP2. Without them, there's no way I'd be sitting here doing this podcast.
Which is obviously the highlight of your career today.
The pinnacle.
But they, of course, they expect results. And I think, in hindsight, when I look back, I didn't do a good enough job of building a personal relationship with Helmut, I think. That's the one mistake I made. You know, I remember being on the flight back from races and stuff. You know, Sebastian Buemi was the other Red Bull driver in GP2 at the time, and he'd be on the phone to Helmut all the time, talking non-stop and building that close one-to-one rapport. And I didn't do a good enough job of that, I think. But what happened was, as we came along to, you know, as things went on, and I understood how hard he was. I mean, he once called me an old man when I was 23. And I didn't know how to react, really.
I've had that before.
You know, as things were developing, I could see, in 2009, you know, you had Sebastian and Mark in the main team. You had Buemi, Al-Ghazali in the wings. Daniel had just signed to do World Series with Jev. So I could see there were a lot of drivers there. And I was fortunate that the Indy Grand Prix was coming along, so I had some backing from them. So I chose to step away from the program and go off on my own. Mm. And actually, you know, I'm one of the few left on good terms. Because, for example, in 2010, when I got to F1, I did an ambassador deal with Red Bull and Helmut and Thomas Uberall, who runs the motorsport program with Helmut. So, you know, I went back and did a brand ambassador deal with them for a couple of years. So
is that while you're racing for Hispania, but with Red Bull backing?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, fantastic.
So, you know, I left things on good terms, and I still have a good conversation, rapport with everyone at Red Bull, for example. You know, I've jumped in to drive their show car on occasion. You know, there were a couple of times where they needed someone to wear a Max Verstappen helmet and do some filming for them, and I jumped in to do that in recent times. So, yeah, I'm, you know, I've been very, very, very conscious that we operate in a very small world and a very small community, and you've got to keep those relationships strong. Mm.
Well, to your point, Harry, I think, you know, talking about is it a damaging thing, this sort of conveyor belt of young drivers? I think certain drivers may be in that line of thought. If you look at the likes of Kvyat and Gasly, you know, how do you think in their minds, what are they thinking? Are they thinking this is the end of the road for me in terms of top level F1, or are they thinking, right, I'm going to knuckle down and I'm going to force my way back in?
Well, it must come down to how mature you are at the end of the day, doesn't it?
But take a step back. They wouldn't be in that position in the first place without Red Bull.
True.
And I think that's the thing. You know, people start getting the violins out and playing the sympathy card for people who get dropped. But if you're delivering, then they won't drop you.
Yeah.
They'll find a way to make it work for you. And that's the reality.
It's a fair point. I mean, Formula One's not a charity, is it? I mean, you know, even harking back to years ago with Hamilton, he would never have got to where, you know, McLaren would have dropped him, Dennis would have dropped him years ago had he not kept winning.
Yeah, exactly.
So just staying in GP2, you started to meet Bruno Senna, and I know you guys are obviously very good friends and you get on quite well. How did that come about? Because you've been teammates in Formula 1, Formula E. You've worked so close together since... Was it GP2 where you first sort of met and became mates?
I mean, we met in 2007, of course, because we were both racing.
Yeah.
Actually, that's not true. We met in 2006 because he was racing in F3 with Double R. And actually, it might have even been 05. Yeah, 05. And I... There was a series called A1GP. That was happening at the time. And the Indian team decided to have a shootout for the seat of the team. It was a complete mess. Anyway, we all get in the car. A bunch of us went down to Pembrey to do this shootout. And it was with Double R. And Anthony Hyatt had spoken to Bruno and said, look, we need to do this thing. We're going to use your car. Do you mind? And Bruno wasn't very happy about it, but he'd gone off to Brazil on holiday. And we were using his car, and I shunted it in a massive shunt.
Oh, correct.
On about lap 5, destroyed the car. And obviously, then there was an awkward conversation with Bruno afterwards to explain it. But we met later that year through the guys at Double R, and then we became friends, you know, in 07. We started racing together in GP2 and spent more time together. Then we really became friends over the winter of 07 into 08, because we both signed with iSport and traveled the world together.
It's amazing how, because you think, can you be friends with someone who is your teammate, who you are?
Lando and Carlos would probably
Well, that's very true, actually. You look at that, and I suppose, clearly you can, but did you ever find, do you see why it's quite easy or for friendships to fail, or for that competitive edge to slide in?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think at the end of the day, it's about a mutual respect thing. You know, you both want to win. You're both competitive people. And of course, you know, I was pissed off when he beat me, and he was pissed off when I beat him. But at the same time, we had a respect for each other.
Yeah.
You know, we respected each other's abilities. We were very transparent with each other. You know, when we went testing and stuff, we were very open with sharing information, and you know, I think iSport as a team were very good at managing that. They would make us do parallel programs and share the information in the debriefs and stuff in a very open way. So we worked together really well. And I think what ended up happening is the families got together as well. You know, Bruno's mum and sisters would come to the races, his manager Chris Goodwin, and my dad would be at all the races. And so we'd all go out and have dinner together. And so the families became friends.
Yeah.
You know, I think that as long as you've got respect for each other, you know, people talk about, you know, Daniel and Max last year, Red Bull having all these issues, but they actually get on.
Yeah.
They get on actually really well because they do have respect for each other. Obviously, Daniel wasn't happy because he was being beaten by Max. And that's a different story, you know, but But in terms of respect, they did respect each other's abilities. And I think as long as you have that, you can get on.
Mm. I think what's going to be interesting, just talking about Lando and Carlos, is because they get on like a house on fire. You know, they're on social media together the whole time. I spent a little bit of time with Lando in America with a couple of interviews, and he was very complimentary about Carlos. I'm just waiting for that day that they crash into each other. Because it cannot surely go on like this with those two being so close. Is that quite an unusual relationship?
Yeah, but again,
but it's quite a modern one as well, though, because obviously it's so social media focused as well, with Lando and his memes and GIFs and all that kind of stuff.
I mean, it is unusual, of course, but I think, again, you want to see that when they're in the pressure for a world championship battle, if that stays. And I think, you know, there are going to be moments where things get a bit rocky. But as long as you're able to talk about it and be transparent with each other and sort it out like two mature people, then I think
it comes down to personality and maturity, like you say.
Exactly.
Formula One, Hispania Racing. I was at Silverstone many moons ago watching a Hispania Racing car, drive around the track.
Yeah.
I was going to say fly, then I reduced it to drive around the track. It sounded a little bit funny. I remember thinking then, that engine doesn't quite sound like all the others. What was it like as a car to drive? Was it difficult? And how was that experience in Formula One for you?
How did it start?
Well, I mean, first of all, the engine should have been the same as everybody else, unless we had a cracked exhaust or something. Look, at the end of the day, the small teams were always going to be up against it. And Hispania as well. It's a shame. To me, it's a team which had a lot of unfulfilled potential, actually, because, we had a partnership with Dallara, which should have been a lot better. But then Colin Collis, who was running the team, fell out with Dallara, and that whole thing turned into a mess. It's a shame, because when I went to the seat fit, you know, Mr. Dallara took me to the wind tunnel, and I went to the design office with the people there. And, you know, we had 60 points of downforce meant to be on the car. So initially, you know, the car we ended up racing the whole season was only meant to go to a hotel in Murcia as a launch. That's all it was meant to do. It was meant to be the launch car at a hotel. And then you were meant to get an update for Bahrain, which was meant to be the race package. Then they went, okay, well, we can't do it for Bahrain. We'll do it for Barcelona. And then it just never came. Yeah. So it's a shame, because it was the people in the engineering office were actually very good. You know, we have Jeff Willis. We had Jeff Willis, who is now one of the top people at Mercedes.
Yeah.
We had Richard Connell, my race engineer, who's one of the top people at Brixworth Mercedes. Tony Chukurea went off to be a chief race engineer at Ferrari. Stephen Mitis became head of the chief engineer of the Porsche LMP1 program.
Yeah.
Team. Chevy Pujala is chief race engineer at Alpha at the moment. We had really good, clever people who've gone on to do good things. And so there was a lot of unfulfilled potential. It's just because the money dried up.
Yeah. It's such a pity. It's so difficult for these smaller teams to come in and stay. You know, it makes the job that people like Haas are doing look incredible.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I think Haas have done a very good job building that partnership with Ferrari and with Dallara, and that's made it work for them. But yeah, it's a shame. But on the flip side, to me, it was a culmination of a dream. You know, it allowed me to be a Formula One driver, which nobody can ever take away from you. You know, from that day forward, your life has changed, and you can always be known as a Formula One driver, which is, later on in life, and it does open other doors, and in terms of your career, that's very important, of course. And you know, going to the paddock for the first time in Bahrain, I'd obviously been to the paddock several times, but going there as a Grand Prix driver, I remember going to, they had the pre-season picture or something on the Thursday, and the first driver who came and shook my hand was Michael Schumacher, and he sort of shook my hand, said, "Welcome to F1, want to know where I'm from," and just polite conversation.
Yeah.
But I just thought he didn't need to do that.
No.
When I was growing up, I had the poster on the wall of, you know, Michael winning his first world championship. And, that it was his return to F1 in 2010 with Mercedes, and he had his own stuff going on, and obviously the world's media chasing him and stuff. Mm. But he didn't need to take 5 minutes to stand there and talk to me, but he did, which I thought was, it was very nice of him.
Amazing.
Wow.
At that point, are you able to take it in? You know, you've got multiple world champions surrounding you. You're lining up on the grid and seeing, you know, the back of Schumacher's car. It must be a surreal experience. Do you take it in there and there, or do you look back now and think, my God, what an experience?
No, I think at the time you're just focused on the job. You know, you're focused on the race. You're focused on what you need to do. So I don't think you actually appreciate it. No, you know, you're under the pressure of the whole thing. So, yeah, I think it's only in hindsight that you sit back and reflect, really.
Yeah.
Obviously a very tough year. How do you keep your mentality to keep striving to get the best out of every weekend? Because obviously I suppose it became apparent very quickly what you were dealing with here. How do you stop it encroaching and try and get on with the job in hand?
I mean, some of the stuff was utterly bonkers. You know, I think Barcelona comes to mind when Colin had done a deal with Christian Kleen to do some FP1 sessions. Obviously, there was some money coming in, I guess. But we, I remember I got in my kit and went into the garage to get in the car at the start of FP1. And Christian walked in the garage in his kit with his helmet. And we both started looking at each other going, what are you doing here? And he went, what are you doing here?
Oh, no.
And then I looked at the car, and the car had my name on one side and his name on the other. So we're like, nobody knew, you know, who was meant to be driving the car until Colin came along and said, obviously, Christian was doing FE1, which, you know.
He's given us a bigger check, so he's going to get in the car.
Nobody had chosen to tell me in advance, which was quite awkward. But, you know, there were moments like that. But it was fine, you know. You know, some of it was completely mad, and you know, in the end, obviously, we fell out with Colin quite spectacularly. And you know, it was weird because we Colin's a strange character because he's unbelievably motivated. He works like a dog, you know. He works absolute hours, 24/7, and he's. He is passionate, you know. He is passionate about it, but he's got lots of flaws and faults along with it. Anyway, we end up falling out for years, and then it was really odd in 2017, in fact, my dad and I were walking down the paddock in Le Mans, and all of a sudden, you know, we just heard this voice saying, "What? You're not going to say hello to me?" It's like, I mean, we've walked past each other many times in the years in between, and he's just blanked me. And suddenly, we just stood in the paddock chatting for probably 45 minutes.
Oh, my God.
And my dad and I just looked at each other like, what is going on? and then since then, you know, I've kept in touch with Colin, and, you know, he and I are both friends with Jonathan Williams, and we've had dinner and together and stuff, and, you know, water under the bridge now, and we've just got on with life. But
he's not tried to get you in his bicolis machine in WEC.
No. He's got a program going with that.
So that's your first season in Formula One. So what were can you take any highlights from that? Obviously, being in Formula One, a combination of a dream. Is there any other standout moments throughout that season?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I always say in the sport, you're racing against your circumstances, even today.
Yeah.
You know, if you're George Russell, all you're doing is racing against your teammates. Mm. If you're an Alpha, you're racing against a midfield pack. You're not competing with Mercedes. So in a similar situation at that time, we were competing against the three other new teams. Now, Lotus were the most competitive of the lot. They were the most organized. They had a bit more funding than the others. So they were slightly out of reach. But, you know, on days, we were competing against them. You know, there were days like Monaco, where I managed to get ahead of the Manor cars, or I suppose they're called Virgin.
Virgin back then, wasn't it? Yeah.
And the Lotuses. And I remember in Canada, I had a good race with Timo. I ended up finishing ahead of Timo. And obviously, you're racing against Bruno as well, because as teammates, you know, so you're trying to compete and beat each other. So, there were races. Valencia, I remember finishing ahead of Lucas in the Virgin car and Bruno, which was a good race for me. You know, so you're picking your battles against the people you're racing with, and it allowed me to be established as a credible racing driver. And that, you know, that's all you're aiming to do in a small team at the back of the grid.
Yeah.
you're not competing for points, you're not competing for wins. You just want to be established as a respectable, credible racing driver.
Mm. Yeah. Now, in the interest of time, I'm going to skip forward a couple of seasons because Formula One, you went into World Endurance Championship racing with the likes of David Brabham. You went into the FIA GT Series. And then 2014-15, Formula E. So Mahindra. So how did this come about? And sell Formula E to me. I'm struggling with Formula E.
I don't know if I can do that.
Yes.
So basically I'd known Alejandro Agag for many years because There was a time I was talking about racing for them in GP2 when he was an owner of Campos and it happened then. So we got talking about me getting involved with the series as one of their development drivers along with Lucas. And then he said to me, he said, look, what's the chance of getting an Indian team involved? So I went back and got in touch with Mahindra and I did all the initial dialogues with Mahindra and I actually brokered the deal between Mahindra and Formula E.
Right, okay.
Oh, wow.
Which, you know, Dilbagh Gill, who's now the head of the Formula E team, never seems to really acknowledge. But, you know, I was part of that process. I think they hired him only in August, but I'd already had several meetings between March and August with them and got the whole ball rolling on that. And then Dilbagh and I worked together to get the deal over the line. So I worked to get them into the series and then, you know, had a contract to race for them for a season. It was a bit of a frustrating season, to be honest. We, we started off quite competitively. I think I finished fifth and sixth in the first two races and should have had a podium in the second race. We had a problem with the pit stop. So we started off reasonably okay. And then as the season went on, we just went backwards. You know, both Bruno and I would be half reasonable in free practice and then we'd qualify together at the back and it just fell apart. I don't know why competitiveness just fell apart and it was a frustrating season, to be honest. And
that team up with Bruno, was that pre-planned at all? Again, no, he did it all himself. That was totally separate.
He done the deal totally independently.
Okay.
I knew obviously he was what's talking to them and what's going on, but it happened independently. It just sort of never worked out, and I found it quite frustrating, really, because, you know, I thought I was putting in all the effort and we just weren't getting the results. And it was a strange car to drive because at that time they didn't have electronic brake balance control. So, it was really difficult to get the brake balance sorted and the regen. And I don't think as a team we were ever as well organized or well, structured at that time. Obviously, now
it was early days.
But so to answer the question on Formula E on the whole, I think it does have a place in the motorsport world because the manufacturers like it, and I think it can coexist in Formula One. But I don't think it should or will replace Formula One. I'm a firm believer that Formula One should be the pinnacle of our sport. It should be the fastest, loudest, sexiest cars with the best drivers on the planet.
Not the loudest at the moment, unfortunately.
No, I agree. That's what I'm saying. It should be. And I think, when you... The Formula E races, there's lots of argy-bargy and there's action and there's a bit of unpredictability and they have different people winning it. But as you say, they haven't really drawn the audiences in yet, have they?
Sort of feel like if, because they're all city centre races, aren't they? You sort of feel like if they took it out, if they put it at Silverstone, would anyone actually go? Because they've got to drive there as opposed to walk down the street.
Yes, point A, but also point B, that they won't look very quick.
When they drive on the Mexico track, they look awful because they go down that start-finish straight and it looks like the slowest thing known to man. Would people come? That's one question, but also I think to make it look better as a sport, it needs to be street circuits.
I think, you alluded to it, the noise is an issue. Like, the sound of an electric car, on the road is quite cool. It's silent, you think great. But when you go to a race and a racetrack, you don't want to just hear tyres screeching. You want to hear you want to hear a roaring engine. And I just really struggle with this sort of quiet Formula E. And like I said, when we were chatting to Nicky a couple of podcasts ago, give them a noise, make them sound like Tron.
Yeah.
But what's funny is, we say that, and I wholeheartedly agree with you. You know, I would love to have the sound of a V10 or a V12 back in F1, for example. But what's funny is this year, the Goodwood Festival of Speed, you know, you had all of these cars, V10s, V12s, making loads of noise and stuff. And then Formula E had a car there. And what was really funny is I spoke to three or four kids who were around 5, 6 years old.
Yeah.
And they all went, oh, daddy, you know, to their dads, going, daddy, those cars are too loud. I like this one.
Really?
And they all like the sound of the Formula E car. So on one hand, I'm going, what's wrong with you? You need to go out and listen to some proper cars more often.
This is an age thing, Karun. You and I are starting to show our age here.
It's that generation Z or whatever. Yeah.
You've worked with some young drivers. Is it who are you involved with, Arjumani?
Arjumani, his younger brother, Kush.
So I used to, in a past life, I managed young racing drivers as well. And even in the early days of Formula E, a lot of those were saying, that's where I want to be. You know, they weren't saying Formula One anymore. It was like, no, Formula One is unrealistic. I'm never going to get there. So, you know, I want to be in Formula E. I get paid to race. You know, it's modern. It's green. It's all the things that I like as a young person.
Yeah, but they're talking about, in all of that, what you just said, the key sentence to me is them saying, I'm never going to get to Formula One.
Yeah, yeah. They've accepted already.
The initial aspiration is still Formula One.
Yeah.
And I think that's really important. And I think F1... hopefully 2021 will carry on what they're doing and retain their place as the pinnacle of the sport. And Formula E can certainly coexist as a separate vertical of the sport, just like Le Mans has done or IndyCar has done or NASCAR has done. Yeah. They've all coexisted for years.
Yeah, yeah.
So there's no reason why that can't happen.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And 2021, while we're on the subject, I'm quite excited about 2021. I've got a good
cars
feeling.
Look great the from cars the sketches.
Look epic. And this whole ground force element, using the base of the car as opposed to the aero on the surface of the car, surely that's going to have an improvement in the racing. Are people going to be able to get closer?
That's the theory, yeah. I think they will, certainly. I think it's a question of how, you know, what we've seen is you know, the first public release of the rules. I'd love to see what happens when we get to 2021, how much of this is still in place. But the theory works. You know, I think back to GP2, when we raced in that, we had a simple single plane, main plane front wing, one single flap.
Yeah.
And most of the downforce came from the tunnels. We had skirts, plastic skirts as well. So you created a real suction effect. And the racing was great. Yeah. We could overtake. We could really follow each other through cops and Becketts and, you know, have some proper racing. I remember, you know, even difficult circuits like Barcelona, you could get decent racing. Yeah. So I think having experienced that, you know, you'd have to say the theory behind 2021 is right. So I'm very cautiously optimistic.
As a aerodynamic novice such as I often wonder why they didn't do this before, because they did it back in the day, didn't they? They had the skirts to create ground effect and then it was banned because it was so effective, and they've not really done it since. And then all of a sudden you're sort of thinking, well, how can we get rid of this dirty air to make racing closer? Create ground effect. It just seems to me, as a layman, it seems like an obvious thing to do. How come it's taken so long for us to do it?
I wish I knew the answer, because frankly they should have done it for the 2017 rule. The 2016 into 2017 rule changes were a terrible idea.
It was
driven by the fact because a bunch of fans got together and went, oh, F1 looks too slow, we need to speed the cars up. But it doesn't matter. No. And all you've done is made the racing worse.
Yeah.
And really, all of that time and money spent to do the 17 cars, because the cars are so big and so heavy now as well. That's the only downside with the 2021 rules. There's going to be another 25 kilos on top. When I drove Montoya's 2004 car, I remember thinking, my God, this thing looks like, it feels like it's going to kill me at every corner. Yeah. It was a brutal, violent attack on my senses. It was unbelievable. 950 horsepower, 605 kilos. It was incredible.
Yeah.
And now we've got cars which are 138 kilos heavier. Yeah. They're going to be another 25 on top. It's a big difference.
How do you feel the Adrian Newey's of this world, for example, are going to feel about these rule changes, when you think there's so much less aero you can put onto the car, less bits and pieces and less sort of using brain power to create airflow and so on? Is that all going to be happening underneath the car, out of sight, creating channels for air underneath the car, or are they still going to be allowed to play around a little bit with the aero on top?
Adrian will hate the rules. Any aero creative person will hate the rules. But we can't let the engineers dictate that. You know, sure. We have to let the show dictate that. We have to let the end product has to be entertaining for the fans. And if you allow engineers to write the rules, it's not going to be. Yeah. You know, we end up with cars which are way too aero sensitive. So unfortunately, we're going to have to ignore that opinion,
yeah.
I think, and go down the path of what makes it better racing. But also, we're going to, you know, as part of the cost-cutting measures, for example, they're freezing the gearboxes for 5 years. I think a lot of their suggestions, suspensions are being simplified, a lot of those things will mean less cost, but it will automatically mean that there's going to be job cuts in Formula One.
Yeah.
Now, that's obviously not popular for the teams because they don't need all these people designing these bits, and, you know, gearboxes are a big department. So on one side you go, okay, that's bad for those people, and you sympathize. But what the hope is, if the costs come down, we can have an 11th and a 12th and a 13th team come into Formula One, and then all of those people with good experience go to those teams, and we have a much bigger spread.
It's a real reset, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think, you know, I know what I've just said is slightly a long-term view, but we have to start thinking like that. And
is that what you want to see, more teams on the grid? Yeah,
I think so. I think it's wrong that, you know, there aren't more seats for new young drivers to come in. I think, you know,
that was the beauty, I suppose, of those three new teams when they came in.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, I was lucky to be at the end of GP2 and ready for Formula 1 in 2010 when those teams came along. You think in 2010, you know, we had myself, Degrassi, Senna, Petrov, Hülkenberg, you know, five people from GP2 all got their chance in F1. Which it doesn't happen
these days.
Often.
It's one, two, if that. Isn't
this,
it? Yeah,
I mean, this year was a bit of an anomaly because you got Lando, George, and Albon. But
go the Brits.
Yeah,
but all very well backed drivers.
Yeah, and I think it's really important for F1 to have two or three small teams. You know, a kid like Nick Cassidy.
Won Japan
in Japan Super Formula Super GT. Japanese F3, he's not even getting a test in F1.
He's a hugely talented driver. I used to look after a guy called Struan Moore who raced against him in Japanese F3, and Nick was just smashing it every weekend. He's the kind of guy that should be coming through into Formula 1. Listen, we could talk about 2021 all day. It's a subject that is fascinating, and there's many opinions about it, but we have a challenge for you, Mr.
Oh, yes.
So we are going to test your knowledge on yourself. Over to you, Harry.
I can't remember which button's the one that does the music.
Oh, God, now you're testing me.
I think it's that one. Hey, there we go. This is quite cool. So this is called Motor Mouths, and it's a game we've come up with where basically we've done it to pretty much almost every guest by the first couple, and we play them bits of team radio, clips from things, and get them to guess three things about each clip, who said it, what they're talking about, and where/the year. Normally it's team radio that relates to the driver. So what I've done for you is I've gone through the archives and I found clips of you.
Oh, wow.
So you should top score on this.
So I think it's actually going to be very, very difficult for you. But so they are clips of you talking and I want you to basically guess and tell me what it was you were talking about and give me the context of the situation and then for another point, where/when. Okay? Okay, so should we hit the first one? Here we go.
Yeah, I mean, it's been a fun day, I have to say. I've really enjoyed it. It's been flat out. You know, you had to be mentally completely attuned with what was going on. But it's been fun. The track actually in the race really was a lot of fun to drive, you know. It got rubbered in, the grip was good. And it was a lot of fun to drive, so I really enjoyed it.
What are we thinking?
That could be in the
I know.
Really.
So you're clearly racing something.
I've had lots of fun days.
I was trying to find team radio from your F1 days, but I couldn't find any. You obviously didn't like chatting on the radio that much.
The radio. Yeah.
I was swore too much. So
any ideas?
Wasn't Formula E. Was it Formula E?
It was Formula E.
Yeah.
Yeah. Give you half a point for that.
Beijing, maybe?
Yes.
Oh,
Beijing?
Hello.
Yes. Okay, Beijing. Yeah. Wait, hang on. I didn't
have that many fun days in Formula E. So.
Can you remember where you finished?
Sixth. Fifth or sixth?
You actually finished fourth.
Did I?
Yeah. So that was you, obviously with Mahindra, on finishing fourth at the Beijing E-Prix in 2014.
Where you had a lot of fun, clearly.
Yeah.
Fun.
So I'm going to give you 1.5 for that one.
I thought I finished fifth.
Wasn't that the next race? Were you fourth and fifth?
I don't know. I think because the battery overheated. I passed Sandberg for fourth, and then the battery overheated, and then he passed me back because I think the last two laps, the battery, I remember the battery at 57 degrees, and I went into a low power mode.
Oh God.
So I'll let Tim Google that, but I might get a bonus point.
He's going to fact check. While he does that, we'll move on to number two. All right, see if you have any idea what this one might be.
Oh, that's the Mercedes from a few weeks ago.
G-force is unbelievable. Given the fact I've got 1,000 horsepower, I can't believe.
I've heard this a lot in the edit.
Are you sure?
I'm fairly sure.
Are you sure? You're not. That's not right.
Oh no, the Williams.
Yes. All right, I'm going to give you 2 for that. You don't get the full marks because you were so convinced that it was Mercedes. But that's a hard one because so that was you driving around Silverstone in the 2017 FW40, isn't it? That sounded like a pretty epic car. And we haven't even got to the Mercedes yet. Okay.
I think you're on that one there. Yeah.
Number 3.
Lucky boy. Such a lucky boy. This is the greatest race
Mansell, in the world. Oh, the Mansell 92 car. You can hear the engine in the
car. Yeah, so it was very emotional music in that one. So that was you driving the Williams FE08C, I believe it was called.
No, FW14B.
Oh, maybe we've got the wrong... Oh,
well,
no.
Hang on a second.
No, was that the wrong one?
I'm not convinced that... I think, Harry, your facts are correct.
Oh.
So just to confirm, Beijing, 20... Oh. What were we looking at? 2014. 14. Fourth place. Three-inch hand up.
I need to get more points money out of it.
I know my facts.
They owe me some points.
See what Dillbag's up to now. You're actually incorrect, Karine, if my knowledge serves me right. So that wasn't Nigel Mansell's. That was the FE08C driving around Monaco. Unless that's been plugged in the wrong way around.
Oh.
Well, we'll find out.
So that one is... I'm going to give you 3, but it could be nothing.
That one.
Depending on this.
No, you could be right, actually. Play that again.
Now he's interested.
Lucky boy. Such a lucky boy. This is the greatest racetrack in the world.
Greatest racetrack in the world. There we go. Oh, Karine.
Harry, I feel like giving you a high five.
I know. He's done it. All right. And final one. You should hopefully get this one.
You sit so much higher. It's so exposed in the cockpit. You could see out the side.
This was the Monaco OHC as well, wasn't it?
No, you have already said this answer.
Oh, Mansell.
This is Mansell's. That was Mansell's. So that was the FW14B round Silverstone. I'm going to give you one for that one.
Well, that's 0, isn't it? I got a completely wrong.
Oh, right, okay. All right. I'm quite generous normally, but
I think this might be our worst score so far.
So you joined the leaderboard. So let's do the math. It's not hard. So let me get the leaderboard up. So you sit with... Karine, it's not looking good. You've got 3.5, and that puts you 5th and last on the leaderboard behind Nicky Shields, who got 5.5. Charlie Martin sits in 3rd with 6th. Bobby Thompson is up in 2nd with 7 points. And Adam Christodoulou sits at the top at the moment with 10 points. Wow. So
shows how much attention I paid to my own voice.
That's a poor effort, Karine. But oh well, thanks for playing Motormouth.
I've got a question for you. Seeing as there is a couple of clips there of you driving Formula One cars, you recently drove the Mercedes F1 car. Would you say that was the best F1 car you've ever driven, or was there something else that really tickled your fancy?
It's a funny one, isn't it, to say what is the best? But in terms of perfection, yes, it was perfect. It was balanced. It had amazing downforce. It was confidence inspiring. It was just as in terms of perfection, yes, it was the best race car ever driven. Was it the most exciting? No. The Montoya car was the one that scared me. The Mercedes didn't scare me at all. It was very confidence inspiring, which is Which is exactly what Mercedes wanted to be, of course. So that you can argue that it is the best car. Emotionally, though, I think the Mansell 92 car was, you know, that's the car I grew up watching, Red 5 and Nigel at Silverstone, the crowd invasion and all that. So,
yeah, I think, I mean, there's an argument, isn't there, that the current F1 cars are almost too easy to drive. Who was that clip of, I think you shared it actually as well, like, there was a clip, was it Vettel, of driving one-handed?
Yeah,
Leclerc through in Japan, wasn't it?
I thought about it in hindsight. I know I shared the clip, but I thought about it in hindsight. And actually in 2010 with the F-duct, they were all doing Eau Rouge with one hand as well. So that was actually a slightly false thing to be telling people. But I think the biggest thing is the weight. Now the cars, because they're so heavy and they're so big. I think Lewis posted a picture on his Instagram earlier in the year of his current car versus his 2008 championship winner. The size difference is unbelievable. And they've got so much downforce and they're so big in terms of the tyre sizes and the floor and the weight now. And therefore they're less on the edge and less exciting perhaps than a... I still believe 2004-05 was the peak of F1 performance. You know, V10s, light, tyre war, very powerful cars, top teams, you know, pushing hard, top engine manufacturers pushing hard, nearly 1,000 horsepower.
Interesting strategies. I guess you've got refueling still then. So,
I mean, I'm not a big fan of the refueling thing, but still, because the cost of it was just ridiculous. And the racing, they were just racing pit stop to pit stop. Really. Yeah. So... But I think that in terms of peak performance, that's still got to be the era of F1 peak performance.
I'm just going to do some questions from people that have messaged us in. So if you don't mind answering them. So Nishi has said, will F1 come back to India?
Unfortunately, I don't see it happening in the short term unless the government has a big change of heart. At the moment, they don't seem to be behind it.
Okay, that's a shame because that track in Delhi looked awesome.
Yeah,
it was great to drive on the video game.
In helping to design Turn 5.
Oh, brilliant! So. Wow,
applause for you.
Yeah, well done. Okay, Danny, what is your prediction on who will be the next superstar in F1? I mean, either they could already be in it, or they haven't risen up yet.
They?
Well, that's
You know, Leclerc, Max. Yeah, I think they're the next two really of the future.
Okay. Being Mazzy has asked off of that, who is the next Indian driver to make it to Formula One? So far, you are the second and so far last Indian Formula One driver.
Yep. I think the next one up in the chains needs to be Jehan Daruvala, who has done a good job in Formula 3 this season. I think he finished third of the championship, did a good season, really. And he'll be in F2 next year. So, we'll see how he gets on.
And this is an interesting one from, just going to say Sat, I think his name is. TV pundits over the years do not seem to have a great opinion on Kimi Raikkonen's driving, while at the same time, he's one of the most adored drivers by fans. Do you agree with that? Or what's your views on Kimi Raikkonen? Especially, obviously, this year's taken a step back in the Alpha now, but he's putting some pretty good drives, as you'd expect from him.
Yeah, I think so. I think the thing is, Kimi's peak was 2003, 2004, 2005, 2006. That's when he was at his absolute peak. He was utterly brilliant. You know, some of those qualifying laps that he delivered in that era at McLaren was just sensational. And I think when he went off to rallying and all the rest of it, and after he won the world championship in 2007, I think he lost that edge a little bit. He's still a very, very good racing driver. I think he's doing a really good job with Alpha, and he's exactly what Alpha need. He's giving them good direction, good experience, and he's delivering. So I think I don't think he deserved the Ferrari seat. I think they were right to put Leclerc in there as a top team. But he certainly deserves his place at Alpha.
Okay. And then we've had another one in, Tim. What's that one over there?
We've got one over on Instagram from Tig Brown. Will W Series help a female driver make a proper break into F1?
I hope so. I think there are a lot of people who, I was a bit surprised about some of the reaction. There were a lot of people against W Series when it first got announced and started off, and I wasn't one of them. I think it's a really good idea. We had a similar situation in India where Honda started a motorcycle category for women to take part in, and the grid was full. And I remember talking to a couple of the girls saying, you know, why haven't you done other categories before? You know, clearly you're interested in it and you want to do it. And they felt that they weren't experienced enough to compete, and they felt a little bit intimidated to compete straight away in the main national championship. And this gave them a chance to get some racing experience, you know, going wheel to wheel with people and stuff. And I think in a similar vein, if the W Series can give some of these girls a leg up and give them an opportunity to kickstart their careers and go off and race in other categories, then that's good for them. What they need for it to really be established is for one of these girls to go off and race in FIA F3 and be winning races and fighting for the championship, because then that underlines their credibility as a championship.
Yeah, there's a couple in there that have got genuine pace. Is it Kovalainen? I can't remember her first name. I think it's Kovalainen. But she is a Finnish girl.
Kimmelainen.
Kovalainen was Heikki.
Yeah, no, she's incredibly quick. And Jamie, as everyone knows, is doing, you know, a sterling job flying the flag for female motorsport. But I'm with you. I think it's good. And we spoke at length with Nikki Shields on this, obviously, with her involvement. And her view was that, you know, if it's creating more participation, more numbers that are coming through, that's, you know, eventually you're going to get one of these girls who can be the next Lewis Hamilton, potentially. So.
Yeah, and I mean, Bernie said to me years ago that the sport has a female racing driver who's delivering in a way that Lewis Hamilton does, she will be the biggest star in the world.
Yeah.
You look at Danica in America. She was unquestionably the biggest star of IndyCar and NASCAR for many years.
Yep. Absolutely.
But because she was able to compete with them.
Yeah.
Okay. A few more just off Instagram, if that's okay. Megan's asked a very good question. Do you have to pass your driving test to race a race car? No, you have to get a separate license.
No, it's
you?
A separate race license.
And then she's also on the back of that, she's gone for the very basic questions. Do you get cheaper or is it more expensive to get actual proper road car insurance if you're a racing driver? Do they take that into account or not?
Yeah, probably.
Yeah. Okay. Fair enough. Interesting. And Tim, I feel like this is a nice one to end the listener questions on. What is your perfect Sunday?
I would say go for a bike ride or a run in the morning.
Yeah.
And then go and get some lunch with the family out somewhere. There's a really good South Indian place actually around the corner from us.
Ooh, so oh, lovely.
Love an Indian.
Bit of a nap in the afternoon.
Perfect.
And then
you've got a child now, you need to get
exactly.
What you can get.
And then watch some motorsport in the evening or watch some fun sport in the evening.
What a perfect Sunday.
Right, we're going to wrap up in a moment. I've got a final four questions for you. And Harry, this is off the cuff, my friend, but I've replaced one of our final four.
Oh my God.
I will kick off with my new question of the final four. What are you rubbish at?
DIY.
Really?
Terrible at painting or hanging things up or anything.
Yeah, same. Likewise. Go on, Harry. Fire one away.
If not racing, what would you be doing?
Probably commentating.
Fair play, yeah.
If you weren't commentating or racing.
If it was outside of the motorsport sphere.
Oh, I don't know.
If that's even comprehensible.
You definitely wouldn't be a builder.
Yeah, probably be... I do like numbers, so I'd be something boring like an accountant or something.
Fair enough. Go on, Tim, you hit the next one.
What's got you excited at the moment? Doesn't have to be race-related.
To be honest, just the prospect of not getting on a plane for all of December and most of January. Mm. Quite, you know, it's been a long season with lots of travel. And, you know, season's sort of done now. I think we've got a couple of races to go, but championships are settled. And got a few little projects in the works as well over the winter. So it'll be nice to spend a bit of time at home and in the office just lining things up for next year.
Mm. And finally, how much would you say of your success and people's successes is about luck and right place, right time? And how much is it down to hard work? Where's the gap? Is there? Is it one or the other? Is it 50-50? Where do you sit on that front?
I think it's probably 70-30 in terms of 70 hard work and commitment to the cause, 30 right place at the right time.
Yeah.
Excellent.
Couldn't agree more.
What an incredible story from start to finish, you know, coming from India, making it to Formula One, getting into broadcasting, which we haven't even touched on broadcasting. We didn't know the whole session. You've done incredibly well to get where you are. You've got a beautiful house here now in the UK and a lovely family, and long may it continue. Karun Chandok, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Excellent cup of tea and biscuits as well.
Thanks.
Thank you so much for listening to episode 9 of the Motormouth podcast. We're nearly at double digits. Thank you so much as well to Karu for giving up his time and inviting us into his house. We'll be back with another episode soon. We've still got some more exciting guests lined up before the year is out and loads to come in the new year. We can't say anything yet, but make sure you keep an ear out as ever. In the meantime, you can catch up on all our previous 8 episodes with Racing Driver and Fernando Alonso protege, Callan O'Keefe, Emmerdale actor and Strictly Come Dancing sensation. He's still in it, Calvin Fletcher. The first ever Top Gear, Stig Perry McCarthy. Our trip to Goodwood highlights episode. Bobby Thompson, Charlie Martin, Nicky Shields or Adam Christodoulou. There's also loads more content on MMTV and on the Motormouth app available to download to any device from any app store. Like, subscribe and review, please. It really helps people find the podcast and helps us to carry on making it. You can follow us on social media as well. On Twitter, it's @Motormouth_, on Instagram, @Motormouth_official, and on Facebook, we're just Motormouth. Have a good one, and we'll see you next time.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey marketers, advertisers, and business owners. Find yourself chatting up the same audience in the same places using the same old lines? Maybe it's time to podcast the net further to catch your next customer. With Acast, there's plenty of fish in the sea with more than 100,000 podcasts and millions of listeners. So there's a perfect match for every business. Use our ad platform to cast your net, then narrow down using targeting such as demographic, show categories, audience segments, and more. Find your match, then reel them in. Advertise on more than 100,000 podcasts with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.